Your Aunt Sookie was the best right fielder in the history of the Lady Falcons, Tara said, squatting down to talk to Hunter eye to eye. Well, I had a good time, I said.
Did you play softball?
Hunter asked Tara. No, I came and cheered for Sookie, Tara said, which was the absolute truth, God bless her. Here, Hunter, Claude said, and gave the softball an easy toss. Go get it and throw it back to me. The unlikely twosome wandered around the park, throwing the ball to each other with very little accuracy. They were having a great time.
Well, 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 Tara said. You have a habit of picking up family in funny places.
A cousin? Where'd you get a cousin? He's not a secret by-blow of Jason's, right?
He's Hadley's son.
Oh. Oh, my God. Tara's eyes widened. She looked at Hunter, trying to pick out a likeness to Hadley in his features.
That's not the dad. Impossible.
No, I said. That's Claude Crane, and he's my cousin, too. He's sure not Hadley's kid, Tara said, laughing. And Hadley's the only cousin you had that I ever heard of.
Sort of wrong side of the blanket stuff, I said.
It was impossible to explain without casting Gran's integrity into question. Tara saw how uncomfortable I was with the subject of Claude.
How are you and the tall blonde getting along?
We're getting along okay, I said cautiously. I'm not looking elsewhere.
I should say not. No woman in her right mind would go out with anyone else if she could have Eric. Beautiful and smart. Tara sounded a bit wistful. Well, at least J.B. was beautiful.
Eric can be a pain when he wants to be, and talk about baggage.
I tried to picture stepping out on Eric. If I tried to see someone else, he might kill that someone else. He sure wouldn't be happy, I said in a massive understatement.
So, you want to tell me what's wrong?
Tara put her hand on mine. She's not a toucher, so that meant a lot.
Truth be told, Tara, I'm not sure.
I had an overwhelming feeling that something was askew, something important, but I couldn't put my finger on what that might be.
Soups, she said.
I shrugged. Well, I got to go into the shop, she said. McKenna opened for me today, but I can't ask her to do that for me all the time. We said goodbye, happier with each other than we'd been in a long time. I realized that I needed to throw Tara a baby shower, and I couldn't imagine why it hadn't occurred to me before now. I needed to get cracking on the planning. If I made it a surprise shower and did all the food myself, oh, and I'd have to tell people Tara and JB were expecting twins. I didn't doubt Claude's accuracy for a second. I thought I would go out into the woods myself, maybe tomorrow. I'd be alone then. I knew that Heidi's nose and eyes, and Basim's for that matter, were far more acute than mine, but I had an overwhelming impulse to see what I could see. Once again, something stirred in the back of my head, a memory that wasn't a memory. Something to do with the woods, with a hurt man in the woods. I shook my head to rid myself of the haziness, and I realized I couldn't hear any voices.
Claude? I called. Here!
I walked around a clump of bushes and saw the fairy and the little boy enjoying the whirligig. That's what I'd always called it anyway. It's circular, several kids can stand on it, a few others run around the edges pushing, and then it whirls in a circle until the impetus is gone. Claude was pushing it way too fast, and though Hunter was enjoying it, his grin was looking a little tense, too. I could see the fear in his brain seeping through the pleasure.
Whoa, Claude, I said, keeping my voice level. That's enough speed for a kid.
Claude stopped pushing, though he was reluctant. He'd been having a great time himself. Though Hunter poo-pooed my warning, I could tell he was relieved. He hugged Claude when Claude told him he had to go to Monroe to open up his club.
What kind of club?
Hunter asked, and I had to give Claude a significant look and keep my head blank.
See you later, sport,
the fairy told the child and hugged him back. It was time for an early lunch, so I took Hunter to McDonald's as a big treat. His dad hadn't mentioned any ban on fast food, and I figured one trip was okay. Hunter loved his Happy Meal, ran the toy car from the container over the tabletop until I was absolutely tired of it, and then wanted to go into the play area.
I was sitting on a bench watching him, hoping the joys of the tunnels and the slide would hold him for at least 10 more minutes, when another woman came out the door into the fenced area with a boy about Hunter's age in tow. Though I practically heard the ominous thud of bass drums, I kept a smile pasted on my face and hoped for the best. After a few seconds of regarding each other warily, the two boys began shouting and running around the small play area together, and I relaxed, but cautiously. I ventured a smile at Mom, but she was brooding off into the distance, and I didn't have to read her mind to see she'd had a bad morning. I discovered that her dryer had broken down, and she couldn't afford another one for at least 2 months.
"Is this your youngest?" I asked, trying to look cheerful and interested.
"Yes, youngest of four," she said, which explained her desperation about the dryer. "All the rest of 'em are at Little League baseball practice. It'll be summer vacation soon, and they'll be home for 3 months."
Oh, I was out of things to say.
My unwilling companion sank back into her own grim thoughts, and I did my best to stay out. It was a struggle, because she was like a black hole of unhappy thoughts, kind of sucking me in with her. Hunter came to stand in front of her, regarding her with open-mouthed fascination.
"Hello," the woman said, making a great effort.
"Do you really want to run away?" he asked.
This was definitely an oh-shit moment.
"Hunter, we need to be going," I said quickly. "Come on now, we're late, late!"
And I picked Hunter up and carried him away, though he was squirming and wiggling in protest, and also much heavier than he looked. He actually landed a kick on my thigh, and I almost dropped him. The mother in the play area was staring after us, her mouth agape, and her little boy had come to stand in front of her, puzzled at his playmate's abrupt departure.
"I was having a good time," Hunter yelled. "Why do we have to go?"
I looked him straight in the eyes. "Hunter, you be quiet until we're in the car," I said, and I meant every word. Carrying him through the restaurant while he was yelling had focused every eye on us, and I hadn't enjoyed the attention. I'd noticed a couple of people I knew, and there would be questions to answer later. This wasn't Hunter's fault, but it didn't make me feel any kinder. As I buckled his seatbelt, I realized I'd let Hunter get too tired and overexcited, and I made a mental note not to do that again. I could feel his little brain practically jiggling up and down. Hunter was looking at me as though his heart were broken.
"I was having a good time," he said again. "That boy was my friend."
I turned sideways to look him in the face.
"Hunter, you said something to his mom that let her know you're different."
He was realistic enough to admit the truth of what I was saying.
"She was really mad," he muttered. "Moms leave their kids."
His own mother had left him. I thought for a second about what I could say. I decided to ignore the darker theme here. Hadley had left Remy and Hunter, and now she was dead and would never return. Those were facts. There was nothing I could do to change them. What Remy wanted me to do was to help Hunter live the rest of his life.
"Hunter, this is hard. I know it. I went through the same thing. You could hear what that mom was thinking, and then you said it out loud."
"But she was saying it in her head."
"But not out loud."
"That was what she was saying."
"In her head."
He was just being stubborn now. "Hunter, you're a very young man, but to make your own life easier, you have to start thinking before you talk." Hunter's eyes were wide and brimful with tears.
"You have to think, and you have to keep your mouth shut."
Two big tears coursed down his pink cheeks. Oh, jeez Louise.
"You can't ask people questions about what you hear from their heads. Remember, we talked about privacy?"
He nodded once, uncertainly, and then again with more energy. He remembered.
"People, grown-ups and children, are going to get real upset with you if they know you can read what's in their heads. Because the stuff in someone's head is private. You wouldn't want anyone telling you you're thinking about how bad you need to pee."
Hunter glared at me. "See? Doesn't feel good, does it?"
"No,"
he said grudgingly.
"I want you to grow up as normal as you can," I said. "Growing up with this condition is tough. Do you know any kids with problems everyone can see?"
After a minute, he nodded.
Jenny Vasco, he said. She's a big mark on her face.
It's the same thing, except you can hide your difference, and Jenny can't, I said. I was feeling mighty sorry for Jenny Vasco. It seemed wrong to be teaching a little kid that he should be stealthy and secretive, but the world wasn't ready for a mind-reading 5-year-old, and probably never would be. I felt like a mean old witch as I looked at his unhappy and tear-stained face. We're going to go home and read a story, I said.
Are you mad at me, Aunt Sookie?
He said with a hint of a sob. No, I said, though I wasn't happy about being kicked. Since he'd know that, I'd better mention it. I don't appreciate your kicking me, Hunter, but I'm not mad anymore. I'm really mad at the rest of the world, because this is hard on you. He was silent all the way home. We went inside and sat on the couch after he paid a visit to the bathroom and picked a couple of books from the stash I'd kept. Hunter was asleep before I finished the pokey little puppy. I gently eased him down on the couch, pulled off his shoes, and got my own book. I read while he napped. I got up from time to time to get some small task done. Hunter slept for almost 2 hours. I found this an incredibly peaceful time, though if I hadn't had Hunter all day, it might simply have been boring. After I'd started a load of laundry and tiptoed back into the room, I stood by the sleeping boy and looked down. If I had a child, would my baby have the same problem Hunter had? I hoped not. Of course, if Eric and I continued in our relationship, I would never have a child. Unless I was artificially inseminated. I tried to picture myself asking Eric how he felt about me being impregnated by an unknown man, and I'm ashamed to say I had to smother a snigger. Eric was very modern in some respects. He liked the convenience of his cell phone, he loved automatic garage door openers, and he liked watching the news on television. But artificial insemination? I didn't think so. I'd heard his verdict on plastic surgery, and I had a strong feeling he'd consider this in the same category.
"Was funny, Aunt Sookie,"
Hunter said. "Nothing important," I said. "How about some apple slices and some milk?"
"No ice cream?"
"Well, you had a hamburger and french fries and a Coke at lunch. I think we'd better stick to the apple slices." I put the Lion King on while I prepared Hunter's snack, and he sat on the floor in front of the television while he ate. Hunter got tired of the movie, which of course he'd seen before, about halfway through, and after that, I taught him how to play Candyland. He won the first time. As we were working our way through a second game, there was a knock.
"Daddy!"
Hunter shrieked and pelted for the door. Before I could stop him, he'd pulled it open. I was glad he'd known who the caller was, because it gave me a bad moment. Remy was standing there in a dress shirt, suit pants, and polished lace-ups. He looked like a different man. He was grinning at Hunter as if he hadn't seen his child in days. In a second, the boy was up in his arms. It was heartwarming. They hugged each other tight. I had a little lump in my throat. In a second, Hunter was telling Remy about Candyland and about McDonald's and about Claude, and Remy was listening with complete attention. He gave me a quick smile to say he'd greet me in a second, once the torrent of information had slowed down.
"Son, you want to get all your stuff together? Don't leave anything," Remy cautioned his son.
With a quick smile in my direction, Hunter dashed off to the back of the house.
"Did it go okay?" Remy asked, the minute Hunter was out of earshot.
Though in a sense, Hunter was never out of hearing, it would have to do. "Yes, I think so. He's been so good," I said, resolving to keep the kick to myself. "We had a little problem on the McDonald's playground, but I think it led to a good talk with him."
Remy looked as if a load had just dropped back onto his shoulders. "I'm sorry about that," he said, and I could have, well, kicked myself.
"No, it was only normal stuff, the kind of thing you brought him here so I could help him with," I said. "Don't worry about it. My cousin Claude was here, and he played with Hunter at the park, though I was there all the time, of course." I didn't want Remy to think I'd farmed Hunter out to any old person. I tried to think of what else to tell the anxious father. "He ate real good, and he slept just fine. Not long enough," I said, and Remy laughed.
"I know all about that," he told me.
I started to tell Remy that Eric was asleep in the closet and that Hunter had seen him for a few minutes,
but I had the confused feeling that Eric would be one man too many. I'd already introduced the idea of Claude, and Remy hadn't been totally delighted to hear about that. A typical dad reaction, I guessed.
Did the funeral go okay? No last-minute hitches? You never know what to ask about funerals.
No one threw themselves into the grave or fainted, Remy said. That's about all you can hope for. A few skirmishes over a dining room table that all the kids wanted to load into their trucks right then.
I nodded. I had heard many brooding thoughts through the years about inheritances, and I'd had my own troubles with Jason when Gran died.
People don't always have their nicest face on when it comes to dividing up a household, I said.
I offered Remy a drink, but he smilingly turned me down. He was obviously ready to be alone with his son, and he peppered me with questions about Hunter's manners, which I was able to praise, and his eating habits, which I was able to admire, too. Hunter wasn't a picky kid, and that was a blessing. Within a few minutes, Hunter had returned to the living room with all his stuff, though I did a quick patrol and found two Duplos that had escaped his notice. Since he'd liked the pokey little puppy so much, I stuck it in his backpack for him to enjoy at home. After a few more thank yous and an unexpected hug from Hunter, they were gone. I watched Remy's old truck go down the driveway. The house felt oddly empty. Of course, Eric was asleep underneath it, but he was dead for a few more hours, and I knew I could rouse him only in the direst of circumstances. Some vampires couldn't wake in the daytime, even if they were set on fire. I pushed that memory away, since it made me shiver. I glanced at the clock. I had part of the sunny afternoon to myself, and it was my day off. I was in my black and white bikini and lying out on the old chaise before you could say sunbathing is bad for you.
Chapter 7. The minute the sun sank, Eric was out of the compartment below the guest bedroom closet. He picked me up and kissed me thoroughly. I'd already warmed up some True Blood for him, and he made a face but gulped it down.
"Who is the child?"
he asked.
"Hadley's son," I said.
Eric had met Hadley when she'd been going with Sophie Ann LeClaire, the now finally deceased Queen of Louisiana.
"She was married to a breather?"
"Yes, before she met Sophie Ann," I said. "A very nice guy named Remy Savoy."
"Is that him I smell, along with a big scent of fairy?"
"Uh-oh. Yes, Remy came to pick up Hunter this afternoon. I was keeping him because Remy had to go to a family funeral. He didn't think that would be a good place to take a kid."
I didn't bring up Hunter's little problem. The fewer who knew about it, the better, and that included Eric.
"And?"
"I meant to tell you this the other night," I said. "My cousin Claude?"
Eric nodded.
"He asked if he could stay here for a while, because he's lonely in his house with both his sisters dead."
"You are letting a man live with you?"
Eric didn't sound angry, more like he was poised to be angry, if you know what I mean. There was just a little edge in his voice.
"Believe me, he's not interested in me as a woman," I said, though I had a guilty flash of him walking in on me in the bathroom. "He is all about the guys."
"I know you are fully aware of how to take care of a fairy who gives you trouble,"
Eric said after an appreciable silence. I'd killed fairies before. I hadn't particularly wanted to be reminded of that.
"Yes," I said, "and if it'll make you feel better, I'll keep a squirt gun loaded with lemon juice on my bedside table."
Lemon juice and iron, the fairy weaknesses.
"That would make me feel better," Eric said. "Is it this Claude that Heidi scented on your land? I felt you were very worried, and that's one reason I came over last night."
The blood bond was hard at work.
"She says neither of the fairies she tracked was Claude," I said, "and that really worries me, but..."
"It worries me, too."
Eric looked down at the empty bottle of True Blood, then said,
"Sookie, there are things you should know."
"Oh, I'd been about to tell him about the fresh corpse. I was sure he would have led off the discussion with the body if Heidi had mentioned it, and it seemed pretty important to me. I may have sounded a little peeved at being interrupted." Eric gave me a sharp look. "Okay, I was at fault. Excuse me.
I should have been longing to be chock full of information that Eric felt would help me negotiate the minefield of vampire politics. And there were nights I'd have been delighted to learn more about my boyfriend's life. But tonight, after the unusual stresses and strains of hunter care, what I'd wanted was, again, excuse me, to tell him about the body in the woods crisis and then have a good long screw. Normally, Eric would be down with that program, but not tonight, apparently. We sat opposite each other at the kitchen table. I tried not to sigh out loud.
You remember the summit at Rhodes and how a sort of strip of states from south to north were invited?
Eric began. I nodded. This didn't sound too promising. My corpse was way more urgent, not to mention the sex.
Once we had ventured from one side of the New World to another, and the white-breathing population migrated across, too, we were the first explorers. A large group of us met to divide things up for better governing our own population.
Were there any Native American vampires here when you came? Hey, were you on the Leif Erikson expedition?
No, not my generation. Oddly enough, there were very few Native American vampires, and the ones that were here were different in several ways.
Now, that was pretty interesting, but I could tell Eric wasn't going to stop and fill in the blanks.
At that first national meeting, about 300 years ago, there were many disagreements.
Eric looked very, very serious. No, really? Vampires arguing? I could yawn. And he didn't appreciate my sarcasm either. He raised blonde eyebrows as if to say,
Can I go on and get to the point, or are you going to give me grief?
I spread my hands. Keep on going.
Instead of dividing the country the way humans would, we included some of the north and some of the south in every division. We thought it would keep the cross-representation going. So the easternmost division, which is mostly the coastal states, is called Moshup Clan, for the Native American mythical figure, and its symbol is a whale.
Okay, maybe I looked a little glazed at that point.
Look it up on the internet,
Eric said impatiently.
Our clan, the states that met in Rhodes compose this one, is Amun, a god from the Egyptian system, and our symbol is a feather, because Amun wore a feathered headdress. Do you remember that we all wore little feather pins there?
No. I shook my head.
Well, it was a busy summit,
Eric conceded. What with the bombs and the explosions and all?
To our west is Zeus from the Roman system, and a thunderbolt is their symbol, of course.
Sure. I nodded in profound agreement. Eric may have sensed that I was not exactly on board by then. He gave me a stern look.
Suki, this is important. As my wife, you must know this.
I wasn't even going to get into that tonight. Okay, go ahead, I said.
The fourth clan, the West Coast Division, is called Narayana from early Hinduism, and its symbol is an eye, because Narayana created the sun and moon from his eyes.
I thought of things I'd like to ask, like, who the hell sat around and picked the stupid names? But when I ran my questions through my inner censor, each one sounded snarkier than the last. I said, But there were some vampires at the summit in Rhodes, the Amun clan summit, that should be in Zeus, right?
Yes, good. There are visitors at the summits, if they have some vested interest in a topic under discussion, or if they are engaged in a lawsuit against someone in that division, or if they're going to marry someone in the division whose time it is to have a summit.
His eyes crinkled at the corners with his smile of approval. Narayana created the sun from his eyes, I thought. I smiled back. I understand, I said. So, how come Felipe conquered Louisiana since we're Amun and is Nevada in Narayana or Zeus?
Narayana. He took Louisiana because he wasn't as frightened of Sofiane as everyone else. He planned and executed quickly and with precision after the governing board of Narayana clan approved his plan.
He had to present a plan before he moved on us?
That's the way it's done. The kings and queens of Narayana wouldn't want their territory weakened if Felipe failed and Sofiane managed to take Nevada, so he had to outline his plan.
They didn't think we might want to say something about that plan?
Not their concern. If we're weak enough to be taken, then we are fair game. Sofiane was a good leader and much respected.
With her incapacitation, Felipe judged we were weak enough to attack. Stan's lieutenant in Texas has struggled these past few months since Stan was injured in Rhodes, and it's been hard for him to hold on to Texas.
How would they know how hurt Sophie Ann was? How hurt Stan is?
Spies. We all spy on each other.
Eric shrugged. Big deal. Spies. What if one of the rulers in Narayana had owed some favor to Sophie Ann and decided to tip her off to the takeover?
I'm sure some of them considered it. But with Sophie Ann so severely wounded, I suppose they decided that the odds lay with Felipe.
This was appalling. How do you trust anyone?
I don't. There are two exceptions. You and Pam.
Oh, I said. I tried to imagine feeling like that. That's awful, Eric. I thought he'd shrug that off, but instead he regarded me soberly.
Yes, it's not good.
Do you know who the spies in Area 5 are?
Felicia, of course. She is weak, and it's not much of a secret that she must be in the pay of someone. Probably Stan in Texas or Freda in Oklahoma.
I don't know Freda. I've met Stan. Is Texas in Zeus or Amon? Eric beamed at me. I was his star pupil.
Zeus, he said. But Stan had to be at the summit because he was proposing to go in with Mississippi on a resort development.
He sure paid for that, I said. If they have spies, we have spies too, right?
Of course.
Who? I'm not missing anyone.
You met Rasul in New Orleans, I believe.
I nodded. Rasul had been of Middle Eastern stock, and he'd had quite a sense of humor. He survived the takeover.
Yes, because he agreed to become a spy for Victor, and therefore for Felipe. They sent him to Michigan.
Michigan?
There is a very large Arab enclave there, and Rasul fits in well. He tells them he fled the takeover.
Eric paused.
You know his life will be ended if you tell anyone this.
Oh, duh. I'm not telling anyone any of this. For one thing, the fact that you all named your little slices of America after gods is just... I shook my head. Really something. I wasn't sure what. Proud? Stupid? Bizarre? For another thing, I like Rasul. And I thought it was pretty damn smart of him to take the chance to get out from under Victor's thumb, no matter what he'd agreed to do. Why are you telling me all this, all of a sudden?
I think you need to know what's going on around you, my lover.
Eric had never looked more serious.
Last night, while I was working, I found myself distracted by the idea that you might suffer for your ignorance. Pam agreed. She's wanted to give you the background of our hierarchy for some weeks, but I thought the knowledge would burden you, and you had enough problems to handle. Pam reminded me that ignorance could get you killed. I value you too much to let yours continue.
My initial thought was that I'd really enjoyed that ignorance, and it would have been okay with me if I'd retained it. Then I had to hop all over myself. Eric was really trying to include me in his life and its ins and outs, and he was trying to help me acclimatize to his world because he considered me a part of it. I tried to feel warm and fuzzy about that. Finally, I said, thanks. I tried to think of intelligent questions to ask. Okay, so the kings and queens of each state in a particular division get together to make decisions and bond, what, every 2 years? Eric was eyeing me cautiously. He could tell not all was well in Sookieville.
Yes, he said, unless there's some crisis that calls for an extra meeting. Each state is not a separate kingdom. For instance, there's a ruler of New York City and a ruler of the rest of the state. Florida is also divided.
Why? That took me aback, until I considered. Oh, lots of tourists, easy prey, high vampire population. Eric nodded.
California is in thirds. California Sacramento, California San Jose, and California Los Angeles. On the other hand, North and South Dakota have become one kingdom since the population is so thin.
I was getting the hang of looking at things through vampire eyes. There'd be more lions where the gazelles crowded around the watering hole. Fewer prey animals, fewer predators. How does the business of, well, of Amon, say, get conducted between those biennial meetings?
There had to be stuff that came up.
Message boards, mostly. If we have to have a face-to-face, committees of sheriffs meet, depending on the situation. If I had an argument with the vampire of another sheriff, I'd call that sheriff, and if he wasn't ready to give me satisfaction, his lieutenant would meet with my lieutenant.
And if that didn't work?
We'd kick the dispute up the ladder to the summit. In between meeting years, there's an informal gathering with no ceremony or celebration.
I could think of a lot of questions, but they were all of the what-if variety, and there wasn't any immediate need for me to know the answers.
Okie dokie, I said. Well, that was real interesting.
You don't sound interested. You sound irritated.
This isn't what I expected when I found out you were sleeping in the house.
What did you expect?
I expected you'd come over here because you couldn't wait an extra minute to have fabulous mind-blowing sex with me.
And to hell with the corpse for the moment.
I've told you things for your own good, Eric said soberly. However, now that that's done, I am as ready as ever to have sex with you, and I can certainly make it mind-blowing.
Then cut to the chase, honey.
With a movement too fast for me to follow, Eric's shirt was off, and while I was admiring the view, his other clothes followed.
Do I actually get to chase you?
He asked, his fangs already out.
I made it halfway to the living room before he caught me, but he carried me back to the bedroom. It was great. Even though I had a niggling anxiety gnawing at me, that gnawing was successfully stifled for a very satisfying 45 minutes. Eric liked to lie propped on his elbow, his other hand stroking my stomach. When I protested that since my stomach wasn't completely flat, this made me feel fat, he laughed heartily.
Who wants a bag of bones? He said, with absolute sincerity. I don't want to hurt myself on the sharp edges of the woman I'm bedding.
That made me feel better than anything he'd said to me in a long time. Were women curvier when you were human? I asked.
We didn't always have choices about how fat we were,
Eric said dryly.
In bad years, we were all skin and bones. In good years, when we could eat, we did.
I felt abashed. Oh, sorry.
This is a wonderful century to live in, Eric said. You can have food any time you want.
If you have the money to pay for it.
Oh, you can steal it, he said. The point is, the food is here to be had.
Not in Africa.
I know people still starve in many parts of the world, but sooner or later this prosperity will extend everywhere. It just got here first.
I found his optimism amazing. You really think so?
Yes,
he said simply.
Braid my hair for me, would you, Suki?
I got my hairbrush and an elastic band. Color me silly, but I really enjoyed doing this. Eric sat on the stool in front of my vanity table, and I threw on a robe he'd given me, a beautiful peach and white silk one. I began brushing Eric's long hair. After he said he didn't mind, I got some hair gel and slicked the blonde strands back so there wouldn't be any loose hairs ruining the look. I took my time, making the neatest braid I could, and then I tied off the end. Without his hair floating around his face, Eric looked more severe, but just as handsome. I sighed.
What is this sound coming from you?
He asked, turning from side to side to get several views of himself in the mirror.
Are you not happy with the result?
I think you look great, I said.
Only the fact that he might accuse me of false modesty kept me from saying,
So what on earth are you doing with me?
Now I'll do your hair.
Something in me flinched. The night I'd had sex for the very first time, Bill had brushed my hair until the sensuality of the movement had turned into a very different kind of sensuality.
No thanks, I said brightly.
I realized that I felt very odd all of a sudden. Eric swung around to look up at me.
What's making you so jumpy, Suki?
Hey, what happened to Alaska and Hawaii? I asked at random. I still had the brush in my hand, and without meaning to, I dropped it. It clattered on the wooden floor.
What?
Eric looked down at the brush, then up at my face in some confusion.
What section are they in? They both in Nakamura?
Narayana. No, Alaska is lumped in with the Canadians. They have their own system. Hawaii is autonomous.
That's just not right.
I was genuinely indignant. Then I remembered there was something very important I had to tell Eric.
I guess Heidi reported back to you after she sniffed out my land? She told you about the body?
My hand jerked involuntarily. Eric was watching my every move, his eyes narrowed. We already talked about Debbie Pelt. If you really want me to, I'll move her.
I shivered all over. I wanted to tell him that the body was fresh. I started out to do that, but somehow I was having trouble formulating my sentence. I felt so peculiar.
Eric cocked his head, his eyes locked on my face. You're behaving very strangely, Sookie.
Do you think Alcide could tell from the smell that the corpse was Debbie?
I asked.
What was wrong with me?
Not from the scent, he said. A body is a body. It doesn't retain the distinctive scent that identified it as a particular person, especially after this long. Are you so worried about what Alcide thinks?
Not as much as I used to be, I said, babbling on. Hey, I heard on the radio today that one of the senators from Oklahoma came out as aware. He said he'd register with some government bureau the day they pried his fangs from his cold, dead corpse.
I think the backlash from this will benefit vampires,
Eric said with some satisfaction.
Of course, we'd always realized the government would want to keep track of us somehow. Now it seems that if the Wares win their fight to be free of supervision, we may be able to do the same.
You better get dressed, I said.
Something bad was going to happen soon, and Eric needed clothes.
He turned and peered at himself in the mirror one last time.
All right, he said, a little surprised.
He was still nude and magnificent, but at the moment I wasn't feeling a bit lusty. I was feeling jangly and nervous and worried. I felt like spiders were crawling all over my skin. I didn't know what could be happening to me. I tried to speak, but found I couldn't. I made my fingers move in a hurry-up gesture.
Eric gave me a quick, worried glance and wordlessly began searching for his clothes. He found his pants, and he pulled them on.
I sank down to the floor, my hands on both sides of my head. I thought my skull might detach from my spine. I whimpered. Eric dropped his shirt.
"Can you tell me what's wrong?"
he asked, sinking down to the floor beside me. "Someone's coming," I said. "I feel so strange. Someone's coming. Almost here. Someone with your blood."
I realized I'd felt a faint, faint trace of this same oddness before when I'd confronted Bill's maker, Lorena.
I hadn't had a blood bond with Bill, or at least not one anything like as binding as the one I had with Eric.
Eric rose to his feet in less than the blink of an eye, and I heard him make a sound deep in his chest. His hands were in white fists. I was huddled against my bed, and he was between me and the open window. In the blink of an eye, I realized there was someone right outside.
"Appius Livius Ocella," Eric said. "It's been 100 years.
Jeez Louise. Eric's maker.
Chapter 8. Between Eric's legs, I could see a man, very scarred and very muscular, with dark eyes and hair. I knew he was short because I could only see his head and shoulders. He was wearing jeans and a black Sabbath t-shirt. I couldn't help it. I giggled.
"Haven't you missed me, Eric?"
The Roman's voice had an accent I really couldn't have broken down. It had so many layers.
"Ocella, your presence is always an honor,"
Eric said. I giggled harder. Eric was lying.
"What is wrong with my wife?"
he asked.
"Her senses are confused," the older vampire said. "You have my blood, she's had your blood, and another child of mine is here. The bond between us all is scrambling her thoughts and feelings."
"No shit."
"This is my new son, Alexei,"
Appius Livius Ocella told Eric. I peered past Eric's legs. The new son was a boy of no more than 13 or 14. In fact, I could hardly see his face. I froze,
trying not to react.
Brother,
said Eric by way of greeting his new sibling. The words came out level and cold. I was going to stand up now. I was not going to crouch here any longer. Eric had crowded me into a very small space between the bed and the nightstand, with the bathroom door to my right. He hadn't shifted from his defensive posture.
Excuse me?
I said, with a great effort, and Eric took a step forward to give me room, keeping himself between me and his maker and the boy. I rose to my feet, pushing on the bed to get upright. I still felt fried. I looked Eric's sire right in his dark and liquid eyes. For a fraction of a second, he looked surprised.
Eric, you need to go to the front door and let them in, I said. I'll bet they don't really need an invitation.
Eric, she's rare, said Okella in his oddly accented English. Where did you find her?
I'm asking you in out of courtesy because you're Eric's dad, I said. I could just leave you outside.
If I didn't sound as strong as I wanted, at least I didn't sound frightened.
But my child is in this house, and if he's welcome, so am I not?
Okella's thick black brows rose. His nose, well, you could tell why they coined the term Roman nose.
I waited to come in out of courtesy. We could have appeared in your bedroom.
And the next moment, they were inside. I didn't dignify that with an answer. I spared a glance for the boy, whose face was absolutely blank. He was no ancient Roman. He hadn't been a vampire a full century, I estimated, and he seemed to come from Germanic stock. His hair was light and short and cut evenly, his eyes were blue, and when he met my own, he inclined his head.
"Your name is Alexei?" I asked.
"Yes,"
said his maker, while the boy stood mute.
"This is Alexei Romanov."
Though the boy didn't react, and neither did Eric, I had a moment of sheer horror.
"You didn't,"
I said to Eric's maker, who was about my height.
"You didn't!"
"I tried to save one of his sisters, too, but she was beyond my recall,"
Okella said bleakly. His teeth were white and even, though he was missing the one next to his left canine. If you had lost teeth before you became a vampire, they didn't regenerate.
"Suki, what is it?"
Eric was not following, for once.
"The Romanovs,"
I said, trying to keep my voice hushed as though the boy couldn't hear me from 20 yards away.
"The last Russian royal family."
To Eric, the executions of the Romanovs must seem like yesterday, and perhaps not very important in the tapestry of deaths he'd experienced in his 1,000 years. But he understood that his maker had done something extraordinary. I looked at Okella without anger, without fear, for just a few seconds, and I saw a man who, finding himself an outcast and lonely, looked for the most outstanding children he could find.
"Was Eric the first vampire you made?"
I asked Okella. He was bemused by what he saw as my brazen attitude. Eric had a stronger reaction. As I felt his fear roll through me, I understood that Eric had to physically perform whatever Okella ordered him to do. Before, that had been an abstract concept. Now, I realized that if Okella ordered Eric to kill me, Eric would be compelled to do it. The Roman decided to answer me.
"Yes, he was the first one I brought over successfully. The others I tried to bring over, they died."
"Could we please leave my bedroom and go into the living room?"
I said. "This is not the right place to receive visitors." See? I was trying to be polite.
"Yes, I suppose," said the older vampire. "Alexei, where do you suppose the living room is?"
Alexei half turned and pointed in the right direction.
"Then that's where we'll go, dearest,"
Okella said, and Alexei led the way. I had a moment to look up at Eric, and I knew my face was asking, "What the hell's going on here?" But he looked stunned and helpless. Eric, helpless. My head was whirling. When I had a second to think about it, I was pretty nauseated, because Alexei was a child, and I was fairly sure that Okella had a sexual relationship with the boy, as he'd had with Eric. But I wasn't foolish enough to think that I could stop it, or that any protest I made would make the slightest difference. In fact, I was far from sure Alexei himself would thank me for intervening when I remembered Eric telling me about his desperate attachment to his maker during the first years of his new life as a vampire. Alexei had been with Okella for a long time now, at least in human terms. I couldn't remember exactly when the Romanov family had been executed, but I thought it was sometime around 1918, and apparently it had been Okella who'd saved the boy from final death. So, whatever constituted their relationship, it had been ongoing for more than 80 years. All these thoughts flickered through my head, one after another, as we followed the two visitors. Okella had said he could have entered without warning. It would have been nice if Eric had told me about that. I could see how he might have hoped that Okella would never visit, so I was willing to give Eric a pass. But I couldn't help thinking that instead of his lecture on the ways vampires had sliced up my country according to their own convenience, it would have been more practical to let me know his maker could appear in my bedroom. "Please, have a seat," I said, after Okella and Alexei had settled on the couch.
"So much sarcasm," said Okella. "Will you not offer us hospitality?"
His gaze ran up and down me, and though the color of his eyes was rich and brown, they were utterly cold. I had a second to realize how glad I was that I'd put a robe on. I would have rather eaten Alpo than been naked in front of these two. "I'm not happy with your popping up outside my bedroom window," I said. "You could have come to the door and knocked, like people with good manners do." I wasn't telling him anything he didn't already know. Vampires are good at reading people, and the oldest vampires are usually better than humans at telling what humans are feeling.
"Yes, but then I wouldn't have seen such a charming sight."
Okella let his gaze brush Eric's shirtless body almost tangibly. Alexei, for the first time, showed an emotion. He looked scared. Was he afraid Okella would reject him, throw him out onto the mercy of the world? Or was he afraid that Okella would keep him? I pitied Alexei from the bottom of my heart, and I feared him just as much. He was as helpless as Eric. Okella had been looking at Alexei with an attention that was almost frightening.
"He's already much better,"
Okella murmured.
"Eric, your presence is doing him so much good."
I had kind of figured things couldn't get more awkward, but a peremptory knock at the back door followed by a, "Suki, you here?" told me that actually the night could get worse. My brother, Jason, came in without waiting for me to answer.
"Suki, I saw your light on when I pulled up, so I figured you were awake," he said,
and then he stopped abruptly when he realized how much company I had, and what they were.
"Sorry to interrupt, Suk," he said slowly. "Eric, how you doing?"
Eric said,
"Jason, this is Appius Livius Okella, my maker, and his other son, Alexei."
Jason nodded at both of the newcomers, but he avoided looking directly at the older vampire. Good instinct.
"Good evening, Okella. Hey, Alexei. So, you're Eric's little brother, huh? Are you Viking like Eric?"
"No," said the boy faintly. "I am Russian."
Alexei's accent was much lighter than the Roman's. He looked at Jason with interest. I hoped he wasn't thinking about biting my brother. The thing about Jason, and what made him so attractive to people, particularly women, was that he practically radiated life. He just seemed to have an extra helping of vigor and vitality, and it was returning with a boom now that the misery of his wife's death was fading. This was his manifestation of the fairy blood in his veins.
"Well, good to meet y'all,"
Jason said. Then he quit paying attention to the visitors.
"Suki, I came to get that little side table from up in the attic. I came by here once before to pick it up, but you were gone and I didn't have my key with me."
Jason kept a key to my house for emergencies, just as I kept a key to his. I'd forgotten his asking me for the table when we'd had dinner together.
At this point, he could have asked me for my bedroom set, and I would have agreed just to get him out of danger.
I said, "Sure, I don't need it. Go on up. I don't think it's very far inside the door."
Jason excused himself, and everyone's eyes followed him as he bounded up the stairs. Eric was probably just trying to keep his eyes busy while he thought, but Ocala watched my brother with frank appraisal and Alexei with a kind of yearning.
"Would she like some true blood?"
I asked the vampires through clenched teeth.
"I suppose, if you won't offer yourself or your brother," the ancient Roman said.
"I won't." I turned to go to the kitchen.
"I feel your anger," Ocala said.
"I don't care," I said, without turning to face him.
I heard Jason coming downstairs a little more slowly now that he was carrying the table.
"Jason, you want to come with me?"
I said over my shoulder. He was more than glad to leave the room. Though he was civil to Eric because he knew I loved him, Jason was not happy in the company of vamps. He put the table down in a corner of the kitchen.
"Sook, what's going on here?"
"Come into my room for a second,"
I said after I'd gotten the bottles out of my refrigerator. "I'd feel a lot better if I had more clothes on." Jason trailed after me. I shut the door once we were inside my bedroom.
"Watch the door. I don't trust that old one,"
I said, and Jason obligingly turned his back and watched the door while I pulled off the robe, getting into my clothes as fast as I've ever dressed in my life.
"Whoa,"
Jason said, and I jumped. I turned to see that Alexei had opened the door and would have entered if Jason hadn't been holding it.
"I'm sorry,"
Alexei said. His voice was a ghost of a voice that had once been.
"I apologize to you, Suki, and to you, Jason."
"Jason, you can let him in."
"What are you sorry for, Alexei?"
I asked. "Come on, let's go to the kitchen and I'll warm up the true blood." We trailed into the kitchen. We were a little farther from the living room, and there was a chance Eric and Ocala wouldn't hear us.
"My master is not always like this. His age, it turns him."
"Turns him into what? A total jerk? A sadist? A child molester?" A faint smile crossed the boy's face.
"At times, all of those," he said succinctly. "But truthfully, I haven't been well myself. That's why we're here."
Jason began to look angry. He likes kids, always has. Even though Alexei could have killed Jason in a second, Jason thought of Alexei as a child. My brother was building up a big mad, actually thinking of charging into the living room to confront Appius Livius Ocala.
"Listen, Alexei, you don't have to stay with that dude if you don't want to," Jason said. "You can stay with me or Suki if Eric won't put you up. Nobody's gonna make you stay with someone you don't want to be with."
Bless Jason's heart, he sure didn't know what he was talking about. Alexei smiled, a faint smile that was simply heart-piercing.
"Really, he is not so bad. He is a good man, I believe, but from a time you can't imagine. I think you are used to knowing vampires who are trying to mainstream. Master, he is not trying to do this. He is much happier in the shadows, and I must stay with him. Please don't trouble yourselves, but I thank you for your concern. I'm feeling better already now that I'm with my brother. I don't feel as if I'll suddenly do something regrettable."
Jason and I looked at each other. That was enough to make us both worried. Alexei was looking around the kitchen as if he seldom saw one. I figured that was probably true. I took the warm bottles out of the microwave and shook them. I put some napkins on the tray with the bottles. Jason got himself a Coke from the refrigerator. I didn't know what to think about Alexei. He apologized for Ocala like the Roman was his grumpy grandpa, but it was apparent that he was in Ocala's sway. Of course he was. He was Ocala's child in a very real sense. It was an awfully strange situation, having a figure out of history sitting in your living room. I thought of the horrors he'd experienced, both before and after his death.
I thought of his childhood as the Tsarevich, and I knew that despite his hemophilia, that childhood must have contained some glorious moments. I didn't know whether the boy often longed for the love, devotion, and luxury that had surrounded him from birth until the rebellion, or, considering he'd been executed along with his whole immediate family, whether it was possible he saw being a vampire as an improvement over being buried in a pit in the woods in Russia. Though with the hemophilia, his life expectancy in those days would have been pretty damn short anyway. Jason added ice to his glass and looked in the cookie jar. I didn't keep cookies anymore, because if I did, I'd eat them. He closed the jar sadly. Alexei was watching everything Jason did as if he were observing an animal he'd never seen before. He noticed me looking at him.
Two men took care of me. Two sailors, he said, as though he could read the questions in my mind. They carried me around when the pain was bad. After the world turned upside down, one of them abused me when he had the chance. But the other died, simply because he was still kind to me. Your brother reminds me a little of that one.
Sorry about your family, I said awkwardly, since I felt compelled to say something. He shrugged.
I was glad when they found them and gave them the burial, he said,
but when I saw his eyes, I knew that his words were a thin layer of ice over a pit of pain.
Who was that in your coffin? I asked. Was I being tacky?
What on earth else was there to talk about? Jason was looking from Alexei to me, mystified. Jason's idea of history was remembering Jimmy Carter's embarrassing brother.
When the big grave was found, Master knew they would find my sister and me soon. We overestimated the searchers, perhaps. It took 16 more years. But in the meantime, we revisited the place where I was buried.
I felt my eyes fill with tears. The place where I was buried. He continued.
We had to provide some of my bones for it, because we had learned about DNA by then. Otherwise, of course, we could have found a boy about the right age.
I really couldn't think of anything remotely normal to say.
So you cut out some of your own bones to put in the grave, I said, my voice clogged and shaky.
In steps, over time, everything grew back, he said reassuringly. We had to burn my bones a little. They had burned Maria and me and poured acid on us, too.
Finally, I managed.
Why was that necessary? To put your bones there? Master wanted me to be at rest, he said. He didn't want any sightings. He reasoned that if my bones were found, there would be no more controversy. Of course, by now, no one would expect me to be alive anyway, much less looking like I did then. Perhaps we weren't thinking clearly. When you've been out of the world so long, and in the first 5 years after the revolution, I was seen by a couple of people who did recognize me. Master had to take care of them.
That, too, took a minute to sink in. Jason looked nauseated. I wasn't far behind him. But this little chit-chat had already taken long enough. I didn't want Master to think we were plotting against him.
Alexei?
Appius Livius called in a sharp voice.
Is all well with you?
Yes, sir,
Alexei said and hurried back to the Roman.
Jesus Christ, Shepherd of Judea,
I said, and turned to carry the tray of bottles into the living room. Jason was clearly unhappy, but he followed me. Eric was fixed on Appius Livius Ocella like a 7-Eleven clerk watches a customer who may have a gun. But he seemed to have relaxed a smidgen now that he'd had a little time to recover from the shock of his maker's appearance. Through the bond, I felt a wash of overwhelming relief from Eric. After I thought about that, I believed I understood.
Eric was relieved beyond measure that the older vampire had brought a bedmate with him. Eric, who had given a pretty good impression of indifference about his many years as Ocala's sexual companion, had had a moment of crazed unwillingness when he actually saw his maker again. Eric was reassembling and rearming himself. He was returning to being Eric the Sheriff from his abrupt reversion to Eric the new vampire and love slave. The way I perceived Eric would never be quite the same again. I knew now what he feared. What I was getting from Eric was that it wasn't so much the physical aspect as the mental. Above all else, Eric did not want to be under the control of his maker. I served each of the vampires a bottle, carefully placing it on a napkin. At least I didn't have to worry about serving an accompanying snack, unless Ocala decided all three of them would feed from me, in which case I had no hope I would survive, and there wouldn't be a damn thing I could do about it. This should have made me the model of discretion. I should have determined to sit there with my ankles crossed and not let butter melt in my mouth, but it just pissed me off. Eric's hand twitched, and I knew he was reading my mood. He wanted to tell me to tone it down, to cool off, to come in under the radar. He might not want to be under Ocala's sway again, but he loved the vampire, too. I made myself back down. I hadn't given the Roman a chance. I didn't really know him. I only knew some things I didn't like about him, and there must be some other things I would like or admire. If he'd been Eric's for real father, I'd have given him lots of chances to prove his worth. I wondered how clearly Ocala could sense my emotions. He was still tuned in to Eric, and always would be, and Eric and I were bonded. But it seemed my feelings didn't carry over. The Roman didn't so much as glance my way. I cast my eyes down. I would have to learn how to be stealthier, and in a hurry. Normally, I was good at hiding what I felt, but the nearness of the ancient vampire and his new protege, their blood so like Eric's, had thrown me for a loop. "I'm not sure what to call you," I said, meeting the Roman's eyes. I was trying to mimic my grandmother's best company voice.
"You may call me Appius Livius," he said, "since you are Eric's wife. It took Eric 100 years to earn the right to call me Appius rather than Master, then centuries to be able to call me Ocala."
So only Eric got to call him Ocala. Fine with me. I noticed Alexei was still at the Master stage. Alexei was sitting as still as if he'd taken a huge tranquilizer, his synthetic blood sitting on the coffee table in front of him with only a sip missing. "Thanks," I said, aware that I didn't sound very thankful. I glanced over at my brother. Jason was thinking he had a pretty good idea about what he wanted to call the Roman, but I gave my head a small but definite shake.
"Eric, tell me how you are doing these days,"
Appius Livius said. He sounded genuinely interested. His hand went over to Alexei, and I saw he was stroking the boy's back, as if Alexei were a puppy. But I couldn't deny there was affection in the gesture.
"I'm very well. Area 5 is prosperous. I was the only Louisiana sheriff to survive the takeover by Felipe de Castro."
Eric managed to sound matter-of-fact.
"How did that come about?"
Eric gave the older vampire a rundown on the political